presentation is entitled Development and Characterization of Microsatellite Markers for Sclerotinia homeocarpa. Alexander Putnam, Ignacio Carbon, and Lane Trebway, NC State University, with Alexander Putnam presenting.
Thank you, Dr. Worth, for that introduction. Good morning, everyone, and thank you all for coming. A dollar spot is a foliar disease that occurs on all species that are commonly cultivated as turf grasses. This disease occurs under a wide range of environmental conditions. And a few of the reasons for a resurgence in recent years in dollar spot include an overall reduction in the use of nitrogen fertility, as well as the development of fungicide resistance, in addition to the concerns over non-target effects of fungicides, have placed more limits on chemical control options. And it is for these and other reasons that dollar spot is the most economically significant disease of turf grass in the world. However, despite the importance of this disease, many of the basic facets of this disease are not well understood. And this includes the basic biology of the pathogen, which, at least for the next 15 minutes, is known as Sclerotinia homeocarpa. And one of those facets I'm going to discuss today is the population biology of the pathogen. Now, early attempts to describe the population structure of this fungus have largely focused on isolates from cool season turf grass hosts in the northern United States. And almost invariably, these studies have found a very low level of genetic diversity within this sample. And so while, as indicated by this example here, they have provided some good descriptions of population structure, as I mentioned, the sampling in the studies that I mentioned were somewhat limited in scope. And secondly, the methods used, such as AFLP here, have not allowed us to make inferences about the evolutionary processes that are generating the pattern we're seeing. And so at NC State, we have been interested in expanding the scope of population structure determination. In previous research conducted by Troy Taylor in our lab, involved 109 isolates of the pathogen that were obtained from C3 and C4, or cool and warm season turf grass hosts, from four different continents. And part of the data that Troy collected included mycelial compatibility grouping, as well as DNA sequence analysis at four different loci. And based on those previous results I summarized, it wasn't too surprising to find a very low level of genetic diversity among the isolates from C3-type grasses. And it also wasn't too surprising to find that of the sample, a high number of them belonged to a single mycelial compatibility group. But what was surprising was where these isolates were found. Isolates from the single belonging to this one of the MCGs were obtained from Chile, Hawaii, North Carolina, New England, as well as the United Kingdom. And a second important finding from Troy's work was that C4 host type isolates were very distinct from and a lot more diverse than C3 host type isolates. So this leads us into several larger or broad scale questions that still remain unanswered. Well, the first being, what are sources of a Sclerotinia homeocarpa inoculum, or where is the pathogen coming from? Particularly the results of finding representatives from a single MCG from many different continents could suggest that there is a common inoculum source for the pathogen that is then being dispersed to these various locales. And secondly, we're interested in seeing what is the structure of the populations of the pathogen at various scales, and how much of it is determined by host type, geography, as well as possibly management practices. And to address these and other questions, a robust set of genetic markers are needed that satisfy two criteria. The first is that they're more polymorphic than DNA substitutions, because as was mentioned on the previous slide, a DNA sequence analysis is not sufficient to distinguish among C3 host type isolates. And secondly, these markers, they need to allow us to make inferences about the evolutionary processes that are generating the diversity we're seeing. And microsatellites are genetic markers that fit these criteria very well. Simply put, a microsatellite is a tandemly repeating unit of a DNA that is 2 to 6 base pairs in length. They mutate by slippage during DNA replication, and the mutation is manifested in the form of length polymorphism. So you can see in this alignment example of a microsatellite, the various isolates in this alignment have different numbers of copy numbers of the repeat motif. Now, looking back at those molecular phenotypic methods I mentioned earlier, They're quite good at detecting diversity and being able to quantify diversity. And you can see which ones are similar and which ones are different. But if you want to ask the question, well, which mutations are causing the differences in the observed pattern, or if you want to compare two particular bands and ask what mutation led to that difference, you can't answer those questions with these types of methods. But with microsatellites, however, you can. Because, for example, looking at these two isolates here, to go between them, it's quite easy to see that there needed to be a gain or loss of this TTC repeat motif. And because this is a defined mutation, we can mathematically model this process, and we can make inferences about the evolutionary processes, such as selection or recombination or migration, that are creating the diversity we're seeing. And so this leads us into the specific objectives for my research that I'm going to talk about today. The first is to isolate and identify microsatellites from Sclerotinia homeocarpa, and then to take a few of these microsatellites and develop them for use as genetic markers that are usable on both C3 and C4 host type isolates of the pathogen. And finally, taking these genetic markers and combining them into multiplex genotyping protocols that will enable us to rapidly screen through a large isolate collection. So microsatellites were initially isolated using a bead capture enrichment protocol, and clone fragments from this library, we obtained 31 candidate loci, and after designing primers and exhaustive testing, we found that three of these were usable as genetic markers. However, once data from the genome sequencing project for this fungus became available, we quickly moved to an in silico isolation, and we identified 6,075 microsatellites from an early draft genome assembly. And to select microsatellites from this over 6,000, we employed a four-step selection criteria. And the first is that the microsatellite in question needs to have enough flanking sequence data to give us enough room to design primers to amplify the microsatellite itself. And this brought the number of candidates from over 6,000 down to 791. And the next step was to design primers and empirically test them for their ability to amplify in both a C3 and a C4 representative isolate. As you can see in the gel photos here, the locus on the left, you can see the increasing annealing temperature in the PCR reaction improved amplification down to a single band or specific band, whereas in the locus on the right, increased annealing temperature did not improve amplification for the warm season isolate, and thus this locus was discarded from further consideration. Next, we expanded the sample test a little bit up to 16 C3 and C4 isolates from four continents, and loci that amplified well in all of these 16 isolates, we then checked the microsatellite itself by direct Sanger sequencing. First, of course, to see that the locus was polymorphic among this sample, but at the same time to ensure that the flanking region was devoid of any length polymorphism. Because in our endgame genotyping protocol, the way we're obtaining the data is simply to find out what the length of the amplified fragment is. And if that length is confounded by insertions and deletions and are not related to those specific mutations I mentioned, that will confound our models. So we wanted to ensure that, or at least be confident that that wouldn't happen when we do our genotyping. Okay, so from the in silico isolation protocol, we tested 87 pairs of primers and selected 11 of those as usable genetic markers. Here's a table briefly summarizing those 14 loci. You can see 11 with the X notation from the in silico protocol. And majority of these loci are trinucleotide repeat motifs, whereas a few others are either tetra or dinucleotide microsatellites. So far, we've identified 3 to 10 alleles per locus. But the main point of this table is to point out the genomic location of these particular loci, or if they're located in coding or non-coding regions. And we use two methods to look at that, either a GeneMark prediction software scan of the recent assembly of the genome, as well as a hard expression data, express sequence tag, a database data that was obtained from transcriptome sequencing at Ohio State University. And we can see that several of the loci are clearly in intergenic regions, meaning they're between genes, and they're likely to be neutral markers that are not affected by selection pressures. Whereas some of them are clearly in coding regions, as indicated by both detection methods here. And these could give us an idea of a population structure that may be influenced by selection. So the basic point is that we have a mix of neutral, of probable neutral, and probable markers that may be influenced by selection. And this could help us, will be quite useful to us in our to our overall goal. And the second point I wanted to make about the characterizing these microsatellites is their distribution throughout the genome. Here we have a schematic of the location of these loci on various scaffolds in this latest genome assembly. For those of you who don't know, a scaffold is simply a large, continuous piece of a DNA that we know is the largest we can obtain in the assembly. I'd like to point out the large size of these scaffolds. The largest down here is in excess of 450,000 base pairs. And as you can see, no two of the loci we're looking at are located on the same scaffold. And thus, this gives us a confidence that they're widely distributed throughout the genome, and thus will be independent representations of diversity throughout the genome, and they are not likely to be genetically linked to one another. So moving on to the addressing the third objective in developing multiplex genotyping protocols, the primers for the 14 loci were tested for compatibility in multiplex reactions using an empirical stepwise process, and it ended up being that 13 of these loci were able to be combined in four different multiplex PCR reactions, whereas the 14th on the far right was not compatible with other loci and thus isn't being evaluated in simplex. And so basically, to genotype, we perform five different PCR reactions using this combination here, and then they're combined into a single capillary. And we're able to do this because of the distribution of the size fragments we're amplifying that were on the previous table. And for those that are overlapping or close to overlapping, they are labeled with a different color dye to allow us to distinguish them from the single capillary. Okay, I wanted to share with you some early preliminary results on the population structure that we've observed from the sample so far. So this is a bar plot output from the program structure, and along the y-axis is each isolate. There are 214 in this sample. Each has its own thin vertical bar. And along the y-axis is the probability that that each isolate belongs to the genetic cluster that are denoted by the different colors. So you can see, as we expected from previous results, a structure based on host type versus C3 versus C4. We're also seeing a structure based on geography in that certain genotypes predominate either inside or outside the U.S., whereas representatives are found from the other genotype. So there is some level of mixing based on geography. So to summarize, we've isolated and characterized 14 microsatellite markers that we can use in both C3 and C4 host type isolates of the pathogen, and we developed multiplex genotyping protocols to enable rapid screening of our isolate collection. In early conclusions from preliminary genotyping is that we've detected previously undetected genetic structure, and that these microsatellites will be very useful to us in our large-scale studies. So with that, I'd like to make the following acknowledgments, this long list, and thank you for any questions.
We have time for one question.
Yes, Dr. Horvath. House,
do you have any hints about what the main factors are in terms of the mixing of the population?
I do not. And we'll have to expand our sampling a little more. This is a fairly limited sample, and we'll have to do much more genotyping to get a handle on it, and also do more advanced analysis. I talked a lot about processes, but that output is just structure. So if we look at more of the back-end processes, we'll be able to figure out or maybe get a handle on what's causing this diversity.
Let's give our speaker a hand.
Thank you.